Faster Mike, good afternoon. Welcome to Manx Radio's Man in Line this Monday, 27th of March. And for the next hour, we're joined live in the studio by the Infrastructure Minister, Chris Thomas, MHK. What would you like to ask him about? What would you like to talk about? Anything from the standard topics of everything from the Liverpool Ferry Terminal, Douglas Promenade, the A5 to Castletown, rental homes, you name it. It's a big brief that he's got to carry. So, I ask you to call in and ask your question on 66 13 68 or text 166 177. Chris Thomas, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Alex. Delighted to be here always. Hello, listeners.
And before we go any further, I'm going to bring up something that the last time you and I spoke here, a gentleman did ring up and ask about the bus shelters on the prom, something that you got quite a bit of criticism for, the state of the reused rusty bus shelters. And I'm going to allow you the point of having a moment of success to start the hour with.
Oh, thank you very much, Alex. At the Esplanade and Mona Drive has got new shelters landside, and we have been talking to Mr. Bagley, and we hope opposite the hotel down the far end of the Northern Promenade we'll have repainted seats quite soon. We're also working on better crossings up the northern end of the promenade, and people will have seen over the weekend some of the defects are begin to be addressed on the crossings and things.
We'll come back to Douglas Promenade a little later on. First of all, though, John Moss joins me in the studio. John, I know we've had some comments from listeners regarding rental homes.
Yeah, I'm just, in this case, a spear carrier entering left of stage on this. I'll be out in a moment. But Mary, not her real name, rang up and said she just listened to a programme on Radio 4 starting at 11 o'clock on the Rental Health. It's the Rental Health series. And this particular one dealt with Highlands and Islands on tourism. And she said it brought out some very interesting points about tourism, about supporting tourism. Two of the main points, upfront funding was necessary to help this sector and to help provide the housing that was needed for tourists coming to this area and encourage them to come so there was availability for them. And also, she said there needed to be regulation, or this came from the programme, regulation of the purchase of second homes. These were the two main aspects that came out of this programme. She recommends the programme for anyone with an interest in this area. It's called Rental Health on Radio 4, to give it a listen.
I enjoy Radio 4. It sounds like a very good listen. I will listen. I think we have a lot of holiday accommodation on the island. It is regulated using 70s legislation. From memory, we might need to look at that legislation, and certainly makes a very good point. We've got 5,000, 6,000 empty homes on the census, vacant properties on the census. We've got properties that don't use electricity as much. It's a very important part of our housing and communities action plan is to look at empty properties and to make policy decisions about bringing those properties back into use. One way is for visitors, another way is for people who live here, and it's a very important initiative we need to work on. Our objective in the island plan is to have 1,000 additional homes occupied, so those homes can either be bringing some of those vacant properties back into use or they can be new homes, and that's a very important point.
Thank you very much for that, Chris. Now, we've got a text in from Paul saying, Alex, can you ask Minister Thomas why the A5 Castletown Road repairs are being delayed? The road is in a dangerous state, yet all the money has been spent on the TT course. Stop fobbing us off with excuses. There is a point, Chris, that we keep on hearing. It just seems to be this current administration's default answer. We've got an economic plan. That is, if that's going to be the cure to all our ills. If we're expecting these extra 15,000 people, we need to invest in our crumbling infrastructure, which is what most people feel the island has got. What was the reason for not upgrading this main arterial route to the airport?
Well, I'm not fobbing anybody off. I'm not fobbing you off. And I'm not going to cite the economic plan. So both of those are wrong.
Excellent.
The simple fact is that the A5 improvement from Ferry Bridge up to Sandton was the procurement documents were drawn up. It was just before my time as a Minister of Infrastructure. The procurement was about to be launched, and then for political reasons, probably somewhere in the Council of Ministers, that procurement wasn't launched. We've been preparing to do the A5 from Sandton to Ferry Bridge for years. That's why all the work has been done on the old Castletown Road and through St Mark's, so that there are alternative roads when the work needs to be closed. We're also taking the opportunity to repair the bridge in the middle of that section as well along the same time. We now need to sort out Balthane Roundabout because that needs doing. The Ballasalla Bypass needs doing, and so I expect 2024-25 we'll be moving over to the A5 as long as we get Treasury funding. It's listed in the inside the proposals to Treasury from infrastructure. Obviously, this year we suffered reductions in budgets because our public assets, our highways assets, are actually better quality, it turns out, than some other public assets, according to the Treasury's analysis. And so, therefore, that's a very, very important priority. There are other ones around the island, for instance, West Quay and Ramsey, for instance, many of the residential roads around the island. We've got a highways plan, we need money for it, and we'll do it as soon as we can. And I agree completely that the A5 is a national priority.
You mentioned there, obviously, that you didn't use two political tropes, but then went and used another one, which is it was cancelled for political reasons. What were the political reasons?
I think there was a worry that we hadn't understood the economic disruption of closing that road for some time. The Department of Infrastructure has always known it's going to be traumatic to close that road. Mm-hmm. It's necessary to close the road, so therefore we wanted to make sure the old Castletown Road and the St Mark's alternative were well planned and there weren't other roadworks going along at the same time.
Who made that decision? Who was the one who actually put the chopping block on the A5 for now?
As I say, it was a very very senior levels in Manx politics, and I wasn't in the council ministers at the time.
Are you saying that someone above your head made the decision above you?
I wasn't. I was a backbencher at that time. But it's a very important priority. It's one of the 30 kilometres of our strategic routes that needs to be done. The 30 kilometres, that's the most important one of our strategic routes that needs to be done, in our opinion, and we will do it as soon as we can, particularly once Ballasalla bypass and the Balthorn roundabout is finished.
There was speculation that there was lobbying involved against actually doing the work on the A5. Is that true, or is it purely down to just, shall we say, conversations inside four walls?
Well, what I heard as a backbencher was that there was worry about the economic impact of that road being closed, firstly. Secondly, there were differences of opinion about what needed to be done to that road. That's the context. We've moved on beyond that now. There's a budget bid that will be decided. Secondly, we need to programme it so it makes sense for the Manx public travelling from the south, because there is going to be severe disruption when that road is done. Mm-hmm. In the same way that when we get to do Woodburn Road and all the roads up through Douglas, there's going to be severe disruption. So they've got to be planned years in advance. We've got to have the alternative routes all prepared. And that's where we are on that major A5 road and things like repairing Woodburn Road in Douglas.
One final thing on that you mentioned there, obviously, it was before your time this decision was made, but you said it was senior people. Is that something that happens, that if the minister wants to go ahead with a project, that it can be overruled? So if this is a case of you are responsible for the upkeep of highways, this is a major arterial route to the airport, that you can be overruled on that?
It hasn't happened to me as yet, but I imagine that does happen, yeah.
Okay. Right, let's go to the phone lines. There's people who would love to speak to you, Chris. Julian is on line one. Julian, good afternoon.
Hi, Alex, and hi, Chris.
Good afternoon, Julian. How are you?
Hiya. Oh, very well. Lovely day.
It is.
It's the solar panels, but maybe not tomorrow. I think we've got raining clouds all day tomorrow. Speaking of which, we've been hearing a lot about the green future, along with the ban on sales of new petrol and diesel vehicles in just 82 months from now. Considering there are currently around 65,000 registered vehicles on the island, what's the Department of Infrastructure's plan and costing for accommodating the huge increase in future electrical generation, along with the installation and cabling of conveniently placed charging points around the island's 700-mile network of roads, which is equivalent to John O'Groats to London? You've also got the heavier electric vehicles causing faster road wear. And as was mentioned earlier, we've got another 15,000 people, taking us up to 100,000.
Well, I'm going to share responsibility with two people. Firstly, the Manx Utilities Authority is responsible for electricity provision, generation provision, running the network. And secondly, I'm going to share it with the whole of the Manx political system, because, you know, what you're outlining as major issues that will affect transport, will affect how we generate energy. And so those decisions are going to have to be no-regret decisions made by Tynwald, with government having taken proposals to it. You were right, the Department of Infrastructure is very, very involved. So currently we've just commissioned, well, we haven't, the climate change team has commissioned decarbonisation scenarios, which is exactly in the spirit that you just laid out in your question. And once we have decisions about what the future will look like for electric car use and home use of electricity, we'll be in a better position to plan our highways, because all the points you make are real points, and, you know, we've got to solve them. And we're not only talking about policy and strategy now, we're talking about practical delivery, given those deadlines and timelines that you've laid down. And in terms of households, you make an incredibly valuable point, which is you can't just miraculously assume that the network can provide electricity or even take electricity if we end up with home generation from every part of the Isle of Man. We've got to have a rational structure for where for where things happen and when things can happen. So, for instance, we can't just imagine that no longer gas will be used in somewhere like Ballasalla for home heating if we haven't thought through what the electricity power would be. And that's around cars and also home heating particularly, because roughly speaking, a car, it has been suggested to me, doubles the amount of load that's required on the electricity power supply if a house has electric car outside it. And if you have a whole street with electric cars outside it, it's got a huge impact. These are really practical questions, and I'm so glad that people like you are making them, because if those questions are on the table, they need to be answered, and sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of this is when the Isle of Man government commissioned the ARUP report for future energy scenarios, I noticed deep within that report the amount that they want to generate by 2050 is only slightly more than we're doing now from Poolrose. So I don't quite see how that's going to work. They talk about putting some interconnector cables across to the UK, but the cost of it on that report, and that this was a couple of years, well, three, four years ago, was just coming up on £1 billion. Now we've got Kroger Gas coming up. We don't really want to be hitched up to volatile gas prices across. And now you've got Ørsted having an office on Athol Street in Douglas. It just seems to me that things seem to be moving in certain directions without any kind of clear plan. As I said, 82 months away, you will not be able to buy a new diesel or petrol car. So it seems that the event horizon is closing in quite quickly here.
No, you make very good points, and that's why I meet regularly with the Manx Utilities Authority. That's why energy policy is moving from just being DEFA-led to being a cross-government activity, because we've got a ticking time bomb if we don't solve these challenges. Petrol and diesel cars is slightly easier in a way. We've got loads of local decisions, but as manufacturers change what they produce in light of the global demand, that things will happen to us. In terms of how we generate electricity, that's very much in our own hands. And I'm not sure about £1 billion for an interconnector, but it's the other side of 100 million at least, and it all depends on how long it is. Also, there's a massive lead time. People are talking about 6 or 7 years to be able to put down a cable. The points you make are brilliant. I've said in public that my focus when I first started was the airport and buses. We've made very good progress in buses, and we're beginning to make some good progress in airport. Behind the scenes, my focus has been using our territorial seas for energy generation. We've got a base load requirement of 30 megawatts or something, 70 megawatts peak load, but Ørsted could generate hundreds of megawatts of electricity offshore. We've got Kroger, which is on a similar location, and behind the scenes, a major priority has been treating those children we have, because we're the other side of the licenses, and with Kroger and Ørsted properly, so that we have a proper regime and we have a proper political process and a proper practical process to make rational decisions. So behind the scenes, there's been lots and lots of work being done to deal the challenges, and I really appreciate you breaking them, because you have described the timescales and the issues properly, and I appreciate that, Julian.
Thanks very much there, Julian, on the line there. Chris, you mentioned in your answer there that there are many questions to be answered. Who's doing the answering? Because we all look to I noticed a theme of this when I talked to you about how these are all very good points and all very good questions. We look to the government and we pay our taxes for you guys to solve these questions. So you've pointed out there that our national grid infrastructure, as it were, is not going to sustain everybody who owns a petrol and diesel car suddenly plugging in electric cars. Mm-hmm. So what's the alternative? What's the government looking at as a policy? Are we going to finally actually invest in decent public transport that's not just buses? Are we going to look at maybe hydrogen vehicles? What's our thoughts?
No, exactly. You make the point. So by in 2024, 2025, we'll agree a transport strategy. And leading up to that, I'm working on a trial on public bus fleet, which you've seen an example of, because we did have an electric vehicle over for 3, 4, 5 years down the road, possibly, conceivably, but there are alternatives for hybrids and hydrogen and other fuels.
I mean, that electric bus, how did it fare in its trial? Because that must suck some power when it's recharging.
Yeah. And I'll probably say too much, but it took 16 hours to charge it up.
Wow.
So, and we'd have to move bus station, and we'd have to have massive fat cables going in to do it. So, and it's much better on urban areas and flat areas than it is elsewhere. That's why we're working with Mercedes and other manufacturers to do that trial. In terms of private vehicles, I have gone ahead of the UK by we've introduced now successfully £65 minimum charge for smaller cars and lower emissions vehicles and electric vehicles. And I've announced that we're calling for evidence this year about what we do in terms of paying for our highways maintenance given different vehicles. In terms of having enough power on the grid, we've got a government scheme for 30 megawatts of onshore generation, and we need to look at where that's distributed, how we handle micro generators of electricity and where we build stuff so that we've got the electricity capacity. I can absolutely assure the public that MUA is working on this intensively. DOI is. We're using our public estate with MUA. We're trying to make sure that the private sector has the proper role, and certainly that the public and private sector are regulated properly as they make contributions. It's a massive issue. Number one issue, I think, probably in my manifesto, no regret decisions on the gas pipeline, on the interconnector, and how we face the future in housing and transportation.
Okay.
Right up there.
You've mentioned it on it there quickly. I'm going to get you on some quick fire questions now, because otherwise you'll be filibustering till one. That a number of texts have come in regarding the road tax and licence fee rise, not just in terms of electric vehicles. Sean says here, did the minister not think about the cost of living before raising the road tax in the year when we're obviously putting up electricity prices and the licence fee? It's an absolute disgrace. What do these ministers think they're doing to the public after COVID? General other complaints from people who say that why will my road tax now be double for the same vehicle in the UK? What's the justification for this? Is it because the DOI are just short of money? Is it a case that when families are already struggling, you're just basically, you know, hitting another nail into the coffin of being able to make ends meet in the budget?
Well, yeah, the budget cycle goes from June, the year before the budget set in February, and it emerged, given decisions about our capital pot and about our revenue budget, that we weren't going to be getting extra central funds. In fact, the opposite, we were getting less. So therefore, it came to us to actually agree with Treasury and then with government and then with Tim Ward how we would make up our budget inside infrastructure. Of course, government's got to take the cost of living crisis seriously, and it certainly did that until the end of March with lots of schemes, including a bus fares cap of £2, which comes to an end at the end of this month.
Why is it then that we're at a point where the UK are now continuing their support for cost of living and we've effectively stopped it? We're ramping up electricity prices. We've stopped the £2 bus fare. Is it a case that actually the UK are being seen as a more compassionate government to their people than we have?
Or it could be that they're being... Yeah, we have a statutory obligation to balance our books sooner. We've got a huge structural financial deficit, 75 million revenue, 75 million capital, so thereabouts.
So it's government incompetence that's led us to this, not the public having to pay for it.
It's not incompetence. It's just, you know, money has been spent. Money will need to be spent in the future. You need to approach that rationally. In terms of the relative cost of vehicle duty in the island versus the cost of vehicle duty outside the island, the simple fact is we maintain 2,000 kilometres of highways in the Isle of Man, 1,000 with asphalt on them, tarmac on them for cars to go on and other vehicles, 1,000 in other forms per head. That's a lot more than they have in the UK. And if we could bring in UK vehicle excise duty into the Isle of Man, but we would get a lower amount of revenue from that. Obviously, the cost of living is putting pressure on people, everybody, but much more. For lower income households.
Can I ask you then,
that's a social security problem and an earnings problem, and basically everybody, however rich or poor they are, needs good roads, and I've got to make sure we have enough money to have good roads.
We look forward to the day when the Isle of Man is considered to have good roads. In terms of the performance indicators, I've got your highway maintenance charter in front of me here, and it says things like surface treatment, percentage of carriageway treated, the UK benchmark is 2.7, our actual performance is 1.75, but there's no targets. Why has the Isle of Man got any targets for condition of principal roads? There's no target for a condition of principal roads in your highways charter. Why is it? If this was an episode of The Apprentice, I'd be pulling apart your business case now. Why is there no targets for the Isle of Man to have conditions of roads in good condition?
So we've got the best database because we had the best surveys of the conditions of the highways compared to other public assets. That's emerged. We didn't know that, but fair play to the guys. Now we're drafting Highways Charter to set those objectives. We're doing it collaboratively with local authorities to whom Some functions have been delegated over the course of the last, 8 years. Once we establish the standards and the targets, we'll then work out how we organise to achieve those targets and how we pay for achieving those targets. So I don't think we can be criticised all round. You know, we're making the situation better. We are getting to a situation where we have standards specified inside public documents, and then we'll explain how we're going to organise and where the, what it's going to cost to meet those targets, and we'll work out how we deliver them.
Now, obviously, we mentioned earlier a bit tongue-in-cheek about how politicians do like to, you know, blame the administration before, I wasn't in that place. Former Transport Minister, Mr Quirk, you was a member of the Department of Transport, weren't you, David?
I was never a minister.
No,
I was
no.
always a pleb on the outside.
How are David? How are you? How
in
are
the
you?
Department. Yeah, Alex and Thomas. By Christ, oh, sorry, shouldn't say that. You two can talk. I wouldn't like to hear being tingled with you two. Listen, can I just ask Mr. Thomas?
I don't get the chance to phone up Manning Line most days. I mean,
but when you're a civilian and I live here and born and bred here, that's my opportunity.
Go on then.
One thing is fairly simple. For some time, we've been trying to find out why a public lane in Willesden, and you may wonder why. I used to live in Willesden. I was born and bred in Willesden, and as a kid, and Charlie will hopefully come on and support me. Why did we close a lane when a previous minister said this has to go down the legal route and the lanes between Watterson Lane and Willesden Crescent? You can't block a lane off or part of the highway without being going to government. Would you not agree?
I agree that the government and Douglas Borough Council have to follow legal process, and if you believe it's unlawful or if it has been unlawful, you have to make a legal challenge. But I think this issue goes back quite a long way, and I think it's in, as you said, it's in Willesden, it's a Douglas Borough Council land, and I do know quite a lot about this issue, but obviously it's not the time and place to get into the wrongs and rights.
David, let me challenge you on this one for a moment, because you know there is this impression that you know the man in line does operate as some kind of that forum to be able to follow these cases up. Have you or the people involved actually used the official legal route? And what's the outcome?
Yes. No, not the legal route. Have you seen the price for visiting a lawyer?
No, I'm talking about as in that Mr. Thomas did say there is a formal process for this, and has that process been followed yet?
It should be taken by the department, because they're the custodians of the public footpaths, highways and such. It should be them to make the decision or challenge Douglas Corporation regarding it.
So, Chris, are you going to be challenging it?
Well, in fact, David's got a report to read in April Tynwald on footpaths law, highways law, carriageways law. So it is an undertaking that we made to Tynwald just before Christmas. DOI had to put down a report on highways. It's not about this specific issue. It's about, you know, the fact we've got nearly 200 disputed routes or routes with issues, and we need to think about changing the law. But yeah, David's got a point. There needs to be formal process. DOI's got a very important role because we are responsible for highways. But I'm not going to get in. I mean, there are two sides in this, and one of them seems to be Douglas Borough Council.
Okay. Thank you, David. We'll be back with Chris Thomas in a moment. The Nation Station, Manx Radio. We're with the Infrastructure Minister, Chris Thomas, on The Man in Line. It's 12:30 on Manx Radio. Chris, when you look on the Steam Packets website regarding the new Manxman vessel, they say, and I quote, "The Manxman has been designed and built entirely for the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company's specifications, and part of the brief is it needs to be fully compatible with all ports that the Isle of Man Steam Packet currently operate to and from, and includes a full mooring study by third-party experts." Why are we spending £3 million then having to adapt and rebuild the end of the King Edward Pier if this vessel has been designed specifically for our port?
Okay, politicians should never do this, but hey, I'm a different type of politician. It's more than £3 million. It was £3 million additional to what had already been approved, but it's actually only half of what was in the original harbour strategy.
So how much is it in total?
It's £3 million plus £3 million, £6 million. So that's the that's the budget approved estimate, and it does say a little footnote in there, which is subject to procurement because the procurement's ongoing as
well.
So
why are we spending £6 million
because
for
basically,
a boat that's
basically
been designed?
Originally in the harbour strategy, it was £15 million. This is not just for the Manxman. This is actually to deal with the King Edward the Eighth Peer. It's to do with general that was opened as a clue in the name. I mean, that was opened in the 1930s, if you think about it. So there is work around that. So Douglas Harbour needed improving. At one point, £80 million of work was identified, including £15 million for that pier. That pier's project work has been downgraded substantially, and in the absolute worst cases, with a completely wrong wind direction, completely bad seas, we needed to put in dolphins and certain things for the Manxman. But basically, it's an overall improvement of the Douglas Harbour.
Now, overall, in terms of sea strategy, I remember in the last administration they debated a lot about possibility of having a national airline like Orany, and it was going to cost us maybe £1 million a year, possibly more, in subsidy, and it was discounted. In terms of, let me just do some figures here. In terms of securing our sea routes, in the last few years we spent £124 million purchasing the steam packet, of which £76 million is a loan to be repaid with interest. Since then, because of a number of mitigating factors, the steam packet recorded a £10.5 million deficit, and then last year a £3.2 million deficit. They also drew down a further £5 million of new capital by issuing shares to Treasury. They've obviously agreed a loan facility with Treasury towards financing the new Manxman, the total cost of which, is circa £90 million. Your department's having to deal with the circa £70 million for the Liverpool Ferry Terminal. We're talking securing sea links here, not necessarily in costs, but we might see a return on some, but we're forking out nearly £300 million here in total costs. Up front, as it were, when we can't afford to fix potholes and we've got problems at the airport and things that you normally come back to me and tell me that actually these budgets have had to be cut. From an administration's point of view, are we reaping the benefits of spending like a drunken sailor over the last few years?
So, I said when I got appointed that I wasn't going to criticise either of my ministerial predecessors at Department of Infrastructure, and there were so many things in what you just asked me, I'm just going to pick up a few ones. Mm-hmm. Potholes, nearly 100%, more than 95% of potholes that are reported on the app officially are repaired within 24 hours. We have an obligation to do that for all sorts of reasons, so we do that. We've got structural problems in our roads, and that's why we need an overall highways plan. You started off by saying, should we think about purchasing an airline? And because of the huge amounts of money involved in the sea services and also how much more planes cost, so the biggest planes that fly across to Asia, and it costs £300 million or something.
Yes,
plus.
They do.
Yep. It's a massive business. So I think you basically made the case that we've got to back smartly with what we've got in terms of running air links. And then you gave me lots and lots of figures about the sea services. Well, I am the other side of the sea services agreement with the steam packet, and I now have regular meetings with the sea services, and we do have lots of work because there is a possibility in 2024 we will have a review of the sea services agreement. That's all in the original sea services agreement, that we wouldn't have a review until 2024, and we can have one in 2024. I think it's quite likely we will have to have one, and that's work in progress for me. Now, to comment on some of those figures, obviously out of the £124 million, as you said, £78 million of that was a loan, which was then refinanced. So that's a bit double counting in one sense. The steam packet's obviously got to make money to pay back that loan. Obviously, the Manxman needed financing.
Of course, yeah,
the boats, as people know, the boats are quite old. I'm not going to go into any details on the Mananan and the Ben McCree, but there's issues around those. And you're all right. With hindsight, I'm sure the post Liverpool Isle of Man Ferry Terminal and Liverpool inquiry will find that we could have done things differently 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, because we've had private sector designers involved in this since end of 2016, 2017. And I think some decisions that were made by previous politicians might not have been the right ones, and I think the steam packet's on record as saying that when it was a private company, whole issues about whether we should go alongside or whether we should have a pontoon, I'm sure they'll all come up again. So I'm not going to defend any decision in the past, because they are bygones. They might teach us something about the future, but now we've got to deal with where we are, and my focus is on getting the Isle of Man ferry terminal to work.
Do you feel there'll be accountability? Because what you've just described there is a very long-winded way of saying lessons have been learned. And really, we're talking, £70 million for an economy of our size when we can't afford lots of things now. We keep on getting the message that government hasn't got the money for this, government hasn't got the money for this. £300 million, circa, I grant you, Are we going to see the return on that? Has that been a good business case of £300 million for various aspects of securing our sea services?
Well, I didn't actually say lessons have been learned. What I did say was I think if you get into airline business, it's even more expensive than into the ferry business. When the decision was made about the Liverpool ferry terminal, I think my political position was that we should have a tender between the six or so companies that had expressed an interest for running the route. In the end, we've ended up owning the ferry terminal at both ends, and also the company that provides the boats in between. So there are decisions that perhaps were made wrongly in the past, perhaps. Minister didn't say that, but the decision to be made, and where my focus now is finishing the Isle of Man ferry terminal in Liverpool. Secondly, making sure that Douglas Harbour works. Thirdly, looking at how sea services work in the future. And fourthly, making sure that we do actually learn those lessons. Hey, I'll use it now when we plan the future of the airport. And I've already said that's what we're going to do with the 10-year master plan. Got a document going to Tim Ward in April.
All right, Stephen's on the line. He's been waiting patiently. Thanks for your patience there, Stephen. You're on with the Minister.
No, it was very, very interesting listening to your questions. And very interesting listening to the Minister's replies. Now, good afternoon, listeners. That's my strap line. So I want to include the listeners in this discussion.
Good afternoon, Stephen.
And some things that you've both said neatly tie into what I want to say. Firstly, I'd like to take the Minister back to his opening remarks where he spoke about 5,000 empty properties. And how are we going to help these 5,000 empty properties get back onto the market and providing homes for people, which would probably help with the 15,000 extra people that no one's voted upon that the Chief Minister wants to bring in to the island? And this comes to my next point, is that we've got the Manx Development Company, which... To coincide with what Alex is saying about raising huge sums of money. Now, it seems to me that we've got mission creep with the Manx Development Company, in as much as they were first to develop brownfield sites. But Westmoreland Road is not a brownfield site. It was full of businesses and operations, and they seem to be buying them up, spending taxpayers' funded money or guaranteed money to enable them to spend this money and buy the site. So that's firstly mission creep. I believe they got 50 million. It could go as high as 100 million. So what I'm concerned over is, and I'd be interested to hear what Alex says and you, Minister, is firstly, how do we get the 5,000 properties back in when Treasury seems to be refusing to give grants and help for older properties, and yet this MDC seems to have ministerial support of to spend a huge sum of money. And it also ties into my next point, is that we've probably got well over £1 billion of money supported by the taxpayer without proper scrutiny of these companies, with either FOE ability or the ability of even Timbald members to scrutinise them, because they'll be told it's an arm's length company. Now we've got the possibility of the airport becoming also an arm's length company, the ability to raise money and guaranteed by the taxpayer without scrutiny. So there's a lot of questions there for you.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stephen, let's give Chris the chance to answer that question. Chris, first of all, I'll start with his last point there. Arm's length companies, yeah, you're thinking about the airport being arm's length, Manx Development Corporation arm's length. We've seen, anecdotally from the public's point of view, this is what happened with Manx Care. So it's never the department's fault, it's always Manx Care. They've inherited all the problems and there's no accountability or scrutiny. Is that the plan?
No. And I also heard, Stephen, he actually asked you what your opinion was first, and then he said he'd come to me, but hey, I'll leave you on that. No,
you're the one with the power, not me.
So in terms of FOI, the actual plan before Tim Ward for the airport in April is that we don't go to either a statutory board or a 1931 company limited by guarantee unless we absolutely have to. We actually want to have a sort of a board to give challenge to the directors and the professionals who know what they're talking about, so we avoid making mistakes, and we actually empower people to make the right decisions, the optimum decisions for the Manx travelling public. I completely agree that it's not really acceptable to exclude people from FOI. So, for instance, under the Sea Services Agreement, people can ask about what the steam packet does under the Sea Services Agreement inside the FOI. That's actually in the Sea Services Agreement. So if the Sea Services Agreement covers it, they can ask the DOI and we'll give them the information. If it's not in the Sea Services Agreement, they have to go to the steam packet, and the steam packet might or might not respond.
So just to confirm, the steam packet, unlike, say, Manx Radio, for example, even though it's a Treasury-owned company, isn't subject to FOI.
No, but you can go to the DOI for anything that's covered by the Sea Services Agreement to find out information about the steam packet. If it's
when you
there.
Review that in 2024, you're going to review their FOI status?
It's definitely on my scandal to review, and Manx Development Corporation the same, and at the airport, if we stay where we are, it'll definitely be included in the FOI regime. Okay. And any civil servant who works with me will say, I think, that the first thing is I say that anything that goes right, you get the credit for. Anything that goes wrong is my fault. So I'm never one to walk away from responsibility. The responsibility is mine in all of these sorts of things.
I do feel that, for once, give you your credit. Whenever you agree to come on Man in Line for me to savage you about things for an hour, you've never said no. So I do credit you with that.
In terms of the vacant properties and the empty properties, I was disappointed with what Mr. Speaker Ewan Watterson said. I mean, I did a reply, but I hadn't actually heard his interview when I had to reply to it, and I am very, very disappointed with what he said about minimum standards. I think I agree with what Stephen's suggesting, which is we've got to work out how to bring these properties back into use. We've not just got to punish people by raising standards, getting even more properties not in use. So that's why I keep stressing that the target in the island plan is 1,000 additional homes occupied, and we have to think about going back to a grant system, working with people across in the UK. They've got a legal arrangement whereby you can make private investment on the basis that you bring them back with our support, and we've got to work out how to do that, because we can't just keep on filling up greenfields with new houses without the public believing that we're actually making the effort of bringing those vacant properties back into use. And in terms of Manx Development Corporation, I'd like to think it's any of these issues that you raise are sort of teething issues, and I'm a passionate believer and on record as being a supporter of a housing association, and the first candidate for housing association would be DOI's properties. That's been policy since 2014 when we had the Tolson review, and I'd love to think that the housing association can work well with Manx Development Corporation to get the most out of public money, whether it be raised through banks or from anywhere else, to actually have a new type of housing between straight public housing from local authorities and straight private housing. The last point on that is I want to make sure that the local authorities out there hear that I want to be partnership. I want to make sure that we're partners as well. So Douglas Borough Council, Ramsey Town Commissioners, Southern Commissioners, who all have houses, are really important in this as well. And we've been encouraging you to make plans. I want to make sure that we can work together for the future of all of the towns and ports and districts around the island.
There we go.
If you're listening, David Kirk, that didn't include Onken, only joking.
Don't wind him up. There we go, Stephen. I hope that answers your question there. We'll be back with the Minister in a moment. We're live with the Infrastructure Minister till one. Chris, I wanted to bring up the independent review and economic impact assessment you're doing for the Heritage Railways. Now, this report, for a start, I can't find publicly the terms of reference. I've got a copy, but they don't seem to be publicly available. Is there a reason for that?
I know it's a public document. They were public while the procurement was going on. We sent them to you and to other people who've been to us, and pleased for you to share them and make them public. No problem with that.
So what is the reasoning behind this? Because we had the Sisterit report as part of the SAVE regime in 2018 that said, of course, they bring a huge economic benefit. There was the Acorus report before that, one that is very difficult to find. You can't find that in the government library. I'm not sure why that's so difficult to find. And there are lots of things in the objectives to this which are quite questionable. I mean, I'll give you one from the terms of reference. It says, analysis of the cost-benefit viability of each major section of the railway on a standalone and combined basis, including evaluation of the impact of the length of the horse tramway and extending the Manx Electric Railway operations to the War Memorial. For a start, we're back onto this point of the horse tramway and Douglas Promenade, that if Tim Wald has voted on the length of it, they've given you the money for it, why are you now doing a report to evaluate the impact of the length of it? Isn't that just subverting democracy? You've been told what to do. You should do it.
Well, no. There's lots of parts to your question. So the terms of reference are public. You feel free to share them. Obviously, you and I have talked before about your excellent railway that you run. So, you know, I'm really delighted that you're so well informed about all of this. And we were delighted to share with you and others the terms of reference to get your input into them. Obviously, we had final say on it. So I'm not trying to say that in any way you approve the terms of reference, but you certainly made some really valuable inputs into it, which we incorporated in the terms of reference. And that's how I want to continue to work with the organisation on which you sit, and also lots of other organisations around the island. In terms of the promenade, £5 million or thereabouts was the cost of including the horse tram tracks along the promenade.
The whole prom?
The whole, Public Accounts Committee are now looking at all of this sort of stuff, and I've seen some figures whereby back in 2017 we talked about £5 million of the overall 20, whatever it is, 7 million or something, being the component of the horse trams, because obviously it was quite tricky putting a railway in the middle of a road, and before that we had the trickiness of putting the railway along the along the pedestrians.
You're dancing around the question. In terms of finishing, completing, reinstating the horse tramway from the tramway tracks from Castlemaine Avenue to the sea terminal, Timwell voted on it, which means there should be no question. You've been told to do it. Timwell gave you the money. So what? The fact that you didn't have, you as a department, didn't go back to Timwell to request to de-scope it or spend the money on something else. You've been given the money, so you shouldn't be asking for more money. You've been told what to do. Why is it not happening?
Well, that's just an arguing point. That's just rhetoric. So in 2020, as I said...
That's fact. That's how democracy works. The Parliament has told your department what to do. It's given it the money. Why are you going against the department? Why is your department going against the Parliament...
As I told the Parliament, Tim Wood, in 2020 it was announced that the project had been de-scoped in an extent, and part of that was
the horse
terms.
And was that voted on?
So where we are now is I have seen, as I told Tim Wood Keys, we have got business cases for reinstatement of the horse tramway all the way to the sea terminal. We have got a business case. Well, not quite a business case, but
these, though, to the Parliament and the House, and you haven't yet.
Well, you can't go to Parliament. I never quite promised that. I think I said we'd make sure we had the process to go from the division to the department to Treasury to government to Timworld, and that's exactly where we are. You'll have noticed from the Pink Book that we've got lots of questions about heritage rail and buses in the forward planning. We haven't even got plans for beyond 2025 for either buses or heritage rail because we've got major reviews going on. And I do hope that you and the community of which you're part and of which I'm part, the people who love and appreciate heritage rail for what it is as part of culture, understand that we're now looking at the prioritising the £2 million or whatever it is to reinstate the horse tramway to the terminal. We need to understand that that's now bidding against Castle Russian High School, against making sure that the Villa Gaiety sound system doesn't fall over next week.
And we understand the difference in, of course, the priorities of government. Is it £2 million now? Because last time you were asking, the figure 750,000 popped up.
Not me. I think that was another minister, and I was just repeating what I heard, but the figures I've seen are larger than that. But it all depends on choices we make. Do we have two lines along the last bit of promenade before you get to the sunken gardens? What do we do at the end when it gets to the sea terminal? Do we have electric tram possibility all the way, or do we not have? There's still lots of options, and I've seen different types of options, but it's almost certainly more than the 750,000. What we've done is we've secured the route that in planning that route is secured. It's not, you know, it's weeds and grass and all that, but it is secured. I have made
your department's official line is meant to be Wildflower Meadow, Chris, not weed. We know it's weeds, but yeah, come on.
Weeds and wildflowers are the same. I'm a passionate believer in wildflowers and weeds as well, but let's not talk about it. I love celandine and that sort of thing. Later in the year, I love all of those, but some people don't.
But I've been doing some research. We've been investing. You know, there's 40 pre-booked groups on the horse trams for this year. Another 50 coach groups. The problem is at the moment that coach groups and, of course, cruise passengers. We heard a lot about at the end of last week how much they spend. They have to get all the way down to Castlemaine Avenue, and even the coach groups, I know from my experience, they now just bypass the horse trams because the coach parking is at the Sefton, as per the new plans. And it's not actually where the horse trams are. So they just bypass the horse trams altogether. It's not a joined-up strategy.
But let's not beat about the bush. It's not only the horse trams and the reinstatement of the original route. It's, as you read out just from one line from the terms of reference, we're asking other questions like, you know, looking at looking at the various parts as to get separately or together. We're looking at the commuter use of the railways. We're looking at the freight use of the railways. We're looking at the value of the lines independently of use as railways. We genuinely want to take Sistra's findings from 5 years ago and to test them against what's happened in the next 5 years, in the 5 years since when they were done. And I've got no preconceived conclusions. I'm really looking forward to having the report by the end of June so that we are in a better place, because we've got people who really know what they're talking about, things that we've been doing wrong.
Is that report going to be worth the paper it's printed on if it's only taken you, it's got what, 2 months to, I'm looking at the terms of reference of which we could be here for hours talking. Is it really going to hold any weight if it's been rushed that quickly? All these comparisons with UK railways, studying figures, operating models.
I think you're arguing a different point from when you started arguing.
Because
Sistra was already 150 pages or something like that from memory. It's already got loads and loads of documents. There was the Echoris one. There's a parallel one for Manx National Heritage. And what I'm basically saying is that wasn't wasted work. That was work that's been done, and that is all part of the current consultants are looking at. And I do hope that we have some valuable independent. Obviously, you hope and you believe it'll come back with the conclusion that it's absolutely vital for the future of the Isle of Man that we reinstate the horse trams to the sea terminal, to the original destination, and that we keep every part of the island connected through heritage rail except for Peel, and that we have huge amounts of use of them. But hey, everything's up for grabs, and I really enjoy talking with you as always.
Thank you very much, Chris. Very quickly, in about the last 30 seconds, the prom, how many defects are still left off the 900 defect list?
Just over 50. People would have seen some people out working on some of them yesterday, because obviously parts of the de-scoped prom was done by DOI workers, and I'm still in negotiations through officers with the designer and the contractor.
Chris Thomas, the Infrastructure Minister, MHK. Genuinely, Chris, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for your time. Good afternoon, listeners.
Thank you very much for all of you who got in touch. Thank you for those of you who texted in. We tried to get through and ask the questions to the Minister. Along the lines, there was quite a lot of topics. I'm sure Chris will come back and answer them again soon. Beth Espy's back on Moneyline tomorrow afternoon. Stand by, Chris Quirk on 1 to 3. Enjoy the rest of your Monday afternoon. Take care. Ta-da.